This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Wyndham Campbell Prizes are one of the world's most prestigious English language literary awards, celebrating achievement across fiction, non-fiction, poetry and drama, with the aim of allowing writers to focus on their creative practice independent of financial concerns. The prizes were the brainchild of the lifelong partners Donald Wyndham and Sandy M. Campbell and are administered by Yale University's Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. They recognise 8 extraordinary writers every year, rewarding each with $175,000. The 2024 recipients were revealed this week and feature the acclaimed British poet Jen Hadfield, the renowned Irish novelist Deirdre Madden, and the award-winning playwright Sonia Kelly. To read about this year's 8 recipients, visit wyndhamcampbell.org or follow the prizes via @WyndhamCampbell.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy. It is the day after Easter, Easter bank holiday as we're recording this, isn't it? How was yours?
It was very good, thank you. It was quite busy. Well, no, there were periods of great non-busyness and small periods of frantic busyness. Which involved Easter eggs and hunting around for them and that kind of thing. So about right, I think. How about you?
Well, I have to say something befell me that I didn't mean to have befall me.
Okay.
And I hesitate to talk about these things because I don't want anyone to think I'm being flippant about religious belief and observance, because I'm really not. But I did not mean to become what I believe is called the occasion of sin.
Oh.
I sort of forgot.
Should we draw a veil now, or do you want to tell us about
it? No, I've got to get it all out there for sort of expiation, yeah. I suppose. I served up bacon because we were having a day off, but it was a holy day of obligation. It was Good Friday. And you mustn't eat bacon, etc.
But what happened? Was there a terrible hush around the room, or did everyone just eat it up?
It gets a lot worse. I revealed this. I mean, I outed myself as this terribly lax person by sending a photograph of our Good Friday brunch, because I had tracked down some crumpets in the shape of bunny rabbits.
Right. I'm having difficulty following now.
I know.
So you had to put a picture of your brunch out because the crumpets in the shape of bunny rabbits, very, very good.
Yes. So took a picture of the crumpets in the shape of bunny rabbits, at the side of which were a couple of rashers, two plates thereof. So not even just, you know.
Someone pointed this out.
Just not even dobbing myself in. Sent it to the family WhatsApp group with the words, "Hello, everybody. Good Friday. Have a lovely Easter." Immediately, what's that on your plate?
Oh, I see. I thought you'd served it to them. No, you just ate it yourself and then outed yourself.
Well, me and my cohabitant, so I cried him as well. It was disastrous. All still turned up for Sunday lunch, mind. They didn't seem that worried.
You should have said quickly that it was faken, and of course it wasn't real, and that it was vegan.
Lucy, this is why I need to have you on speed dial. You should have rung me.
Well, you probably shouldn't, because that would have been an occasion of sin as well, because then that would have been a fib.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but I would have got away with it if it hadn't been for et cetera, et cetera.
I think that's not the message of
that's not the message of Easter. No, quite correct. What did you do? Tell me something you did to get us off this terrible subject of my illicit bacon and bacon serving practices.
Okay, I'll tell you something apropos. I read a book, which, you know, is not in itself unusual, but it was one of those nice things when I just picked something up. You know, I didn't have to read it.
Nobody's given it to you and said, can you read this by Thursday?
Yeah. It was lovely. I was just sort of wandering about and picked it up. And it was brilliant. It's You Dreamed of Empires by Alvaro Enrique. I don't know if you've read it or read any of his.
I have not. Tell us more.
So brilliant. Well, the first one of his I read was called Sudden Death. And the thing is, what he writes about, I have no knowledge of, so I'm very innocent of it. It's not like I have ideas of it already. He wrote, this one is a bit like a counterfactual of Cortez going to meet Moctezuma.
Oh, that sounds very good. Just the thing for a holiday weekend.
Well, it was just, he's so brilliant because he writes about these very serious, quite difficult to understand, quite difficult for me because I didn't know much about the history or the geography, very little. These kind of weighty, massive occasions which have huge repercussions. And they feel weighty and important, but he's also very, very funny. And the people in it are absolutely recognisable. Do you know what I mean? That you feel like you just might turn a corner and bump into them, even though they're high priests and princesses or, you know, captains who've been at war for years and years. And it's just brilliant. It's about a far off history, a sort of counterfactual, but there's sort of bonkers bits in it. T-Rex, the band, make an appearance at one point.
Always good.
Yeah. and it's, I highly recommend it. It's not new, of course. I'm not, it was out in January, relatively new.
It's relatively new.
But this is just a kind of serendipity.
Say again the name for everybody.
You Dreamed of Empires. It's by Alvaro Enrique. And it's translated by Natasha Wimmer. I think she works with him a lot, and it's a brilliant, brilliant translation as well.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're so welcome.
Very good. Shall we dive into what else we have going on this week?
Perhaps we should.
Because we're going to be joined by Bill McKibben, aren't we, to talk about the climate emergency from a sort of global perspective. And then we were talking a little bit last week about my adventures in Switzerland, and we're going to have a conversation with Hisham Mattar from the Bibliotopia Festival that I visited when I was there.
But first, a couple of months ago, we talked about how the climate emergency is being treated in Westminster. And now we're taking a broader look, a global look. There's a new book out called The Exhausted Earth, Politics in a Burning World by AJ Singh Chowdhury, described by our reviewer as an important book about why business as usual is not going to get us out of the climate crisis. And our reviewer is the author, professor and environmentalist Bill McKibben. And we're really delighted that he can join us today to talk it all through. Bill, many thanks for joining us.
Well, what a pleasure to be with you all.
Well, it's very kind of you, calling all the way from Vermont, I think, today.
Indeed.
I mentioned our earlier episode because in that one we talked about the book The Price is Wrong by Brett Christophers, which you also mentioned in your piece, and you talk about big business and its approach to renewable energy. And you say, we now live on a planet where the cheapest way to produce power is to point a sheet of glass at the sun, which will bring profits, but not oil company type profits, will it, to the companies making and controlling the energy. And that's a part of the problem, isn't it?
Well, it depends on, I mean, it's the problem if you're Exxon. This is the great paradox of the moment that we're in. We have, thanks to great scientists and engineers, a sudden abundance of cheap energy. Solar power and wind power, which is just another form of solar power, are the two cheapest ways to make power on our planet. They can produce an almost unlimited number of electrons, which we can then can use for all the things we need: heating, transportation, cooking, on and on and on, even increasingly heavy industry. But if you're Exxon or BP or Shell or Total or Saudi Aramco, or you look at that and you think, man, that's the stupidest business model of all time. Because once you've set up your solar panel or your wind turbine, the sun and the wind deliver the energy for free. That is to say, Exxon no longer has control over its reserves of energy that it's been mining for 100 years and selling to us piecemeal and making an extraordinary profit in the process. Just last month, the CEO of Exxon, I'm talking about it because he was talking about it himself, gave an interview to Fortune magazine in which he said Exxon would be having nothing to do with renewable energy because it didn't offer above average returns to our investors. That's not only a cynical and disgusting reason for destroying the planet, but it is a candid appraisal of one of the reasons that we're not moving as fast as we need to be moving to replace ruinous fossil energy with clean energy.
Yeah. So yes, sorry. And yes, by problem, I didn't mean what a problem that we've got all this lovely cheap energy. The problem is how to sort of change the model. And this book, The Exhausted, this is kind of addresses how people are going to need to do that. You say they need to stand up to that business as usual in new large scale ways. That's what the book is trying to address, isn't it?
Right. So I think we've perhaps have wandered into a place where we think that economics is going to solve our problem for us. Now that we have cheap renewable energy, why wouldn't we move in that direction? And if we lived in a world, I guess, governed entirely by economics, we might. But wealth and power are so closely linked, and possession of wealth gives you access to so much political power that it allows the fossil fuel industry to game this system, which they've been doing for 30 years with outright climate denial. And now they're doing with kind of solutions denial, doing everything they can to slow this transition. So we need a movement, and a big one, in order to catalyze and accelerate this movement off fossil fuel. And it better come soon. Because, well, 2023 was the hottest year on this earth in the last 125,000 years. So far, 2024 is hotter still. The toll that it's already taking is astonishing, but the existential danger ranks second to perhaps only all-out nuclear war on the list of problems that humans have imagined for themselves. And in this case, the bombs are going off. So this book is one important insight into, in part, how to go about building that movement. The author recommends thinking hard about a solution that would work for a majority of people, which he describes as creating a kind of modest paradise, not a utopia, but a place where everybody had access to some kind of reasonable minimum of heat and space and food and so on, something that most of the world obviously doesn't have access to at the moment. It's a very powerful argument, a reconfiguration, really, in his case, of the kind of arguments from the 1960s in the period of decolonialization about access to political power and sovereignty and things. Mm-hmm. And he draws quite directly on Frantz Fanon and the Wretched of the Earth, and he conjures up the Exhausted of the Earth, which in our case is probably a better phrase. It encompasses not only people suffering from extreme poverty, but millions of people suffering from the kind of increasingly bizarre and inhuman strain that our screen-addled world puts on our lives.
Well, I wonder if I can ask you, how do you in this kind of world of these companies who, as you say, are trying to do everything to slow down an energy transition, how do you see government's role in that? I mean, globally, how do they get past the way that they're hooked up to big business, the way that I'm partly thinking of this because I'm talking to you from Ireland, where I live, where we're in the closing window of a public consultation on the latest climate action plan. Mm-hmm. And Ireland, you know, the Irish government have said very, and I'm sure it's replicated in governments across the world, have said, you know, we really need to ratchet up what we are doing to move to entirely renewable energy sources. At the same time, one of the reasons that Ireland is enjoying a degree of wealth at the moment is because a lot of companies have decided to base their data centres here. You know, so we know that there are these kind of vast data centers, all sort of satellited around Dublin, that are bringing in a lot of wealth to the company. Now, I'm just using this as an example that's close to hand to me. How do governments kind of play these, work out how to, which course to steer is what I'm asking?
Yes, well, it's a very interesting question. And I mean, the obvious answer is for most governments would be a quick crash course in building renewable energy. In the course of Ireland, that probably means a lot of wind power. This is entirely possible to do. Germany this year is producing more than 50% of its power from renewable energy. And it's not like Germany, I mean, nobody's ever gone to Germany for a beach vacation, you know. The problem lies especially in those huge governments where the equation is complicated by the real power of the fossil fuel industry. The US and Russia and Saudi Arabia and Brazil, which, you know, is a progressive government under Lula, but announced last week that it plans to quickly pass Russia and Kuwait to become the third biggest national oil company in the world. The political power of the fossil fuel industry has to be broken. And Ireland, I will say, has done its part, at least in some ways. It became the first country in the world a few years ago to divest its public holdings from the fossil fuel industry, thanks, among other things, to great activism from our friends at Trocare. So that's a good example of trying to stand up some to this industry. It's truly depressing to watch the Conservative government in the UK decide that now, in the hottest year in human history, would be the right moment to open up the North Sea for yet another round of oil leasing. That is as pathetic as what my country, you know, has been doing as it builds out its LNG, its liquefied natural gas export capacity, or as pathetic as what the Saudis are doing as they open up new oil fields, or on and on and on.
In the book, Chowdhury, he's saying that the movement needs to be led by this mass of people, the exhausted, which, as you say, is not people necessarily. I mean, it is also people in poverty, but it's the people who are at least in precarity and under stress, which is an enormous amount of people. But there's a major problem in his approach that you see, isn't there, which is how he thinks this large-scale activism is going to operate.
Well, I think this is an interesting question, and I don't really know the answer to it, but I've staked my life's work on trying to figure out how to use nonviolence, which I think is one of the most interesting technological developments of the 20th century. If you asked me the two most interesting technologies of the last century, they'd be the solar panel and the nonviolent social movement. He poo-poos the idea of using nonviolence and thinks that we should, well, I think he thinks that somebody should pick up a gun or a bomb or something and get this revolution going. He's very taken with Andreas Malm and his book/movie, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, and seems thrilled by the Hollywood version of it and the idea of people using violence to catalyze things. To me, this seems an unlikely outcome here. That may be in part because in the country where I live, the concentration of assault rifles is in the hands of the people who'd be least likely to use them towards these ends. But in general, I think picking the weapons that the power structure has an abundance of is probably a mistake. And instead, you know, we've actually managed to, as it were, blow up a pipeline or two with nonviolent social movement building. The Keystone Pipeline being the best example, and one that I spent a good part of the last decade working on. So I'm very hopeful that we can continue to develop this infant technology of nonviolence in the same way that we're developing this nascent, growing, ever more mature technology of solar power and wind power and batteries. And to me, they combine beautifully to produce the kind of change that we need on this planet.
But you're right, Bill. I mean, there evidently has to be a massive citizen buy-in, doesn't there, to these technological advances?
Absolutely. And I think this may be one of the places where the environmental movement has not done as well as it should have in recent years. There's been a heavy bias towards a kind of technological way of speaking and thinking, and less of an effort to build the kind of symbols of hope that we need. Personally, I think that that's possible to do. I think it's a quite a remarkable moment, the one that we're now in, as of the last 2 or 3 years, when the cheapest way to produce power is to point a sheet of glass at the sun, as you said. And what that means is, if you think about it, that we could get rid of combustion here on planet Earth, stop burning things like we've been burning them for many thousands of years, with the great benefit not only of short-circuiting the climate emergency, but cleaning up the air. 9 million people on this planet, one death in five is attributable to breathing the combustion byproducts of fossil fuel, and cleaning up our politics. I mean, the other problem with fossil fuel is, if you rely on a resource that's only available in a few places, the people, Vladimir Putin, King of Saudi Arabia, who control those resources, get outsized power, which they tend to abuse. Sun and wind are everywhere. And so the prospect of replacing energy from hell with energy from heaven should be a remarkable, empowering, enlightening, almost transfixing spectacle, not unlike the transfer of political power in the 1960s to newly emerging countries as empire broke away. Mm. The empire that holds us in its grip at the moment is in large measure this empire of fossil fuel, and breaking its power would be extraordinary. Now, I'm not, I mean, look, his emphasis on violence is sort of understandable. I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, where we began the process of taking on the then greatest empire in the world, the British Empire, and we did it with muskets, you know. But nonviolence hadn't been invented yet. And so I think that there's more of a chance that we will be able to get there if we build movements of a beautiful kind.
Well, and you mentioned as well, the most celebrated one is Gandhi. And also you mentioned Martin Luther King, but Chowdhury's not sort of convinced by them, is he?
He draws on scholarship that says, for instance, that Gandhi didn't win Indian independence by himself, that there were also violent and armed resistance movements and so on, which is true. But the argument that in its very first iteration, nonviolence didn't by itself bring down the biggest, most powerful force on earth, the British Empire, it does not strike me as a overwhelming argument to do anything except go out and get better at using it, explore what it means. Look, every country on earth has an academy devoted to figuring out how to get good at violence. I mean, it's West Point in my country, Sandhurst.
Yeah, we have a lot of them.
So yes, we got good at that kind of stuff. But when we build these big nonviolent social movements, we're basically making it up as we go along. We're getting better at it. We're learning more about how it works and how to build that power and what it looks like. And there are plenty of signs that it's at least as effective. The Harvard political scientist Erica Chenoweth has published widely her data showing that nonviolent revolutions are more likely to succeed than violent ones. I'm not completely sure where Chowdhury's rejection of this comes from. I do think that there tends to be a kind of leftist sort of thrill sometimes around the idea of revolutionary violence. But I confess it's always left me a little bit cold. But then you have to understand, you know, I mean, I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so that's probably enough in the eyes of him and more committed activists to disqualify my thinking on this anyway. But plod on we will, and we've won some big victories. 350.org, which I started, the first big global iteration of a climate movement, has organized about 20,000 demonstrations in every country on earth except North Korea. And there's a lot of places where we've been able to block a lot of projects and continue to do so. Now I spend my time organizing old people like me. We've started this very fast growing movement in the US called Third Act for people over 60. And in the fall, we organized a big nonviolent campaign to take on America's LNG exports, and working hand in glove with people there on the front lines along the Gulf Coast, we were able to at least get the Biden administration to pause what's become the biggest, fastest growing carbon bomb on the planet. The Third Act last spring organized civil disobedience in 100 cities outside the four biggest banks in the world, Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, which are also the biggest funders of the fossil fuel industry. We shut them down for the day. I will confess that we're too old to sprawl comfortably on the sidewalk. So we went to,
we took some chairs.
We borrowed hundreds
of
rocking chairs.
Coming up right behind you, Bill. Really, really not much good. The problem is, I think if I get down, I won't get up.
That's right. So we borrowed hundreds of rocking chairs. The next day, the New York Times called it the Rocking Chair Rebellion.
And no violence in sight.
Look, there's no guarantees that we will prevail. At the moment, I'd say we're losing. The Arctic and the Antarctic are melting fast now. And the Amazon may well be in a kind of spiraling savannification as it dries out. There's only so many huge physical features on our planet, and most of them now are in rapid and dangerous flux. So I'm not trying to be Pollyanna. I'm trying to look for the things that seem to me to have the highest chance of success. And those things are solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, and the goodwill of great masses of people coming together to try and make dramatic change in the ways that we organize our lives.
Mm. I must say, it's very inspiring talking to you, Bill. It really is. And it sort of reminds me, I interviewed a little while ago after he'd won big literary prize in the UK, John Vaillant, mm-hmm. and read, you know, the terrifying realities in his book, Fireweather, mm-hmm. but he was still really optimistic, and he said kind of similar thing to you. It's very exciting time to be alive and think about the change that you can make.
I don't know if I'm optimistic or not, but I'm willing to keep on fighting, and we win enough of these battles to at least give us the thought that we should keep carrying on. There may come a point when that really fades, and I think that the thing to remember about climate change, and here Chowdhury is very good, is that it's a time-limited problem. It's not like the other problems that we faced. You know, Gandhi backed off several times in the Indian independence movement because he thought it wasn't ready yet. And so for a decade, he would put it on hold. Well, we don't have decades to spare. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has told us we need to cut emissions in half by 2030, which by my watch is 5 years and 8 months away. That's on the bleeding edge of the technically possible, even if everybody on Earth was working with good faith. The fact that we have a huge industry working entirely in bad faith makes it all the harder. And it's why, in addition to great engineers making ever better solar panels, we need great organizers building ever stronger movements, ever more clever, creative, and engaging movements that promise enough to enough people to really begin to change this tide. And there, I think Chowdhury's emphasis on the exhausted is a very, very powerful way of framing this, and a new one for me, and one that I was grateful for.
Well, thank you very much for talking us through this, and for, I don't know how to say it, it's a reality check, but also a bit of hope as well, and getting the rocking chairs out.
It's a great pleasure to talk with you all, and when you get your rocking chairs out, send a picture, and we will spread it everywhere.
We will. Thank you so much.
God bless.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, a conversation with the novelist Hisham Mattar.
And to read all the pieces we talk about and much more, remember to subscribe to the TLS. Just head on over to our website at the-tls.co.uk.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Now, if you were listening last week, you'll have heard that I was at the Bibliotopia Festival in Switzerland, listening to fascinating writers and eating a lot of cheese. I did do a little bit of work in the form of interviewing the Libyan-born writer Hisham Mattar about his new novel, which was published at the beginning of the year. And I'm delighted to say we can bring you a little bit of that conversation here.
I have loved your work since the very beginning. This novel is an extraordinary novel. I think it has taken you... Well, I said to you yesterday when we were chatting, it feels like the kind of novel that takes you many years to write. And you said, well, all my life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a book that I've been thinking about for a long time, you know. And I thought, I've been thinking about it since 2012, when I had this idea for a novel about friendship, and particularly about three male friends, and particularly three Libyan male friends exiled in London. And I thought that would be a good way to write about something that is very difficult to talk about, which is questions of temperament, you know, and I felt the novel is really a place for temperament. And so to have these three very intimate men who are temperamentally different, who agree on a lot of things, but their temperaments are different. So I had that idea and I wrote the first couple of pages, and then I just didn't know what happens next. And they are really, it's really the opening of the book. And
that survived, yeah, that initial...
I carried it in my head. I mean, I know I will be reading to you from it, but just to give you an impression of how it was sort of hosted in my mind, you know, I would be walking around with those lines. You know, it is, of course, impossible to be certain of what is contained in anyone's chest, least of all one's own, or those we know well, especially those we know best, but as I'm monitoring my old friend Hossam Zua and so on, I would just have this in my mind.
You do your and whole reading by heart, do you?
and I really genuinely didn't know what happens next. There were clues in it, you know. So that's what I initially thought. I had started thinking about it in 2012. But then, a few years ago, the British Museum asked my wife and I to do a little exhibit. My wife is a visual artist, and the British Museum holds some of her work, and they wanted her to do a display about that work called Evidence, and then asked me to do a display about my book, The Return, and use objects for the British Museum and objects from our own archive, if you want to put it that way. And I was looking for things that I was in my box of scribbles around the time I was writing The Return, and I found a note from much earlier, from 2003, when we were living in Paris, where on the back of an envelope I'd written an idea for a novel, just three lines, and it's basically this book, you know. It's an idea about you know, three friends who start in the same place and end up in different places. That was sort of the way I'd written it on the back of the envelope. So it's certainly a book that...
it's really gestated.
It's been
and then to have written The Return, your work of nonfiction that is, well, nearly 10 years ago, certainly since you
started. Yes,
2016 it came out. That's an entirely different kind of writing.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't feel like that to you.
It doesn't
Maybe
really.
Maybe the gap between fiction and nonfiction doesn't feel so definite.
Yeah, it doesn't. And also I feel that, I mean, in some ways it is definite. I feel I am much more, naturally, much more of a novelist. I mean, I think that way. And writing nonfiction, I wrote nonfiction in the way that I would imagine a novel would be constructed, you know. But the other thing that is harder to account for when you ask a question like that, one of the things I think about is how to account for this strange thing that happens where you feel that every book you've written has rewired your imagination in some way. That the books that you write, in other words, are your fate, not only in the sense that you can't choose them, or at least I don't feel I'm sitting and choosing, oh yeah, which book I'm gonna write. I mean, I have a choice. The choice is not to write it. But I don't feel that I have a choice in the kind of book that I write. I don't really think that's a choice. So they're your fate in that sense, but they are also your fate in the sense that in the time it takes to write a book like that, it takes me a good number of years to write a book like that, the book is also working on you. You're also being written by it in some way.
Hisham does that, and we will talk about friends, we really will, but I'm now going to follow you down this rabbit hole because it's so interesting. If the book is in some sense, and you may be talking in a way at a kind of metaphorical level, you may not, your fate, can you change your fate in the writing of it? I mean, you are manipulating that. You may not have a choice about whether to write it, other than to not write it.
Yeah.
There are choices all the way through in writing novels, aren't they? I mean, that's one
I'm sure that's true. But the way it's experienced, at least in my sense, is that I'm involved in a practice, and this practice leads me down certain ideas, certain themes, certain sounds, certain language, structure, rhythm, all of these things that I am working with day to day, and they cultivate me, you know? They ask of me certain things that I'm not sure in an abstractly sort of blank day I would seek those things. So down to what I'm reading, what I'm listening to, the music I gravitate towards, the people I gravitate towards, I don't want to make it too dramatic. It's not, you know, totally like that. But in some way, the companionship of the book that you're writing is an emotional and intellectual companionship that, like all of the other relationships we have in our life, they educate us, you know.
I think thinking about the book as it starts, and we'll hear a little bit from the beginning of it in a minute. It's about three friends, and quite rightly you say that temperament is a key thing that marks them as different from one another, and their temperaments, also in that triangular friendship, work differently between each of them. Yeah. But there's also time. Time is a huge part of this novel, and you work across sort of two time structures, don't you? There is a very small period of time in which our narrator is walking through London, recalling things.
Yeah.
And there are all the things that he's recalling.
Yeah.
And the ebb and flow of friendship, what happens within relationships, changes so profoundly over the course of those times.
Yeah.
At just the same time as vast, as it were, public, historical, national events are happening. Such a complicated and interesting structure.
Well, I think time, I mean, for all writers, time is really the secret protagonist, you know. It's really, and we also know from our experience of time that not all time is the same. And it's not necessarily always linear. Sometimes it's circular. Sometimes it's there are stratas of time. There are certain moments in our life that feel incredibly deep, where time stretches in a different way. And there are days and days and days, or if you're like me, there are months and months and months where they just shrink. You don't actually have much of a recollection of them. So all of that has always fascinated me as a reader. And as a writer, I've always gravitated towards that. I found that so interesting. It's one of the reasons for why music has been so important for me, because music thinks about time in ways that sometimes seem much more explicit. You know, you could sort of and so one of the things that I wanted to create is I wanted to create a moment, one of those moments where everything opens up. And you know, those moments in time that we have all gone through them, a certain quality of light, a certain hour that opens up in your day and you're just ready enough that you feel something happens. There's a much more expansive capability in it. And a lot of things get absorbed in that, or can do. So I wanted a novel that's situated in one of those moments, unhurried, vast, but very specific. It's a walk. He's walking from St. Pancras to Shepherd's Bush. It takes about 2.5 hours. And but the whole book is narrated across that walk. And years, of course, decades are expressed. So time in that sense, but also stratas of temperament. You know, different kinds of moments are he's able to conjure up. And then on, and whilst all of that is happening, he's of course making his way through London and the city that he knows very well. So I became very curious. You know, that first page I mentioned to you, it is of course impossible to be certain of what is contained in anyone's chest, least of all one's own, or those we know well, perhaps especially those we know best. But as I stand here on the upper level of King's Cross Station, from where I can monitor my old friend Hossam Zua walking across the concourse, I feel I can see right into him, perceive him more accurately than ever before, as though all along, during the 2 decades that we have known one another, our friendship has been a study. And now, ironically, his portrait is coming into view. No, that sentence had in it all sorts of clues for me that this is a book about time, about that infinite, complicated distance between what is in our chests and what is expressed, which I feel is the gap where literature resides, really. Yes. That's where it sits, right? So in other words, that it was a book about a farewell, but also about time and the distance between the heart and expression.
You're going to read that opening chapter to us now. And of course, what it does is put the reader on alert. It's a 3-page chapter, and you're on alert that there is going to be complexity and perhaps regret and difficulty and confusion, emotional confusion, because we know, again, from your very straightforward title, this is going to be a book about friendship, but it begins, as you say, with a farewell, and quite possibly a permanent farewell.
Yeah, yeah. Shall I do that now?
Yes, please.
Okay. I will stand up. I hope you don't take that as a. It's not. I don't mean it to be threatening. It's more out of respect
than
anything.
Nobody took that as threatening. Yeah. Now we're all wondering.
That's one thing's gonna charge. Yeah. Okay. And now, lovely interpreters, to whom I am hugely grateful, both as a listener and now as someone on the stage, and thank them enormously for their work. We'll read from the French translation. It is, of course, impossible to be certain of what is contained in anyone's chest, least of all one's own, or those we know well, especially those we know best. But as I stand here on the upper level of King's Cross Station, from where I can monitor my old friend Hossam Zoua walking across the concourse, I feel I'm seeing right into him, perceiving him more accurately than ever before, as though all along during the 2 decades that we have known one another, our friendship has been a study, and now, ironically, just after we have bid one another farewell, his portrait is finally coming into view. And perhaps this is the natural way of things, that when a friendship comes to an inexplicable end, or wanes, or simply dissolves into nothing, the change we experience at that moment seems inevitable, a destiny that was all along approaching like someone walking towards us from a great distance, recognizable only when it is too late to turn away. No one has ever been a nearer neighbor to my heart. I'm convinced, as I watch him go to his train for Paris, that city where the two of us first met so long ago and in the most unlikely way, that he is carrying, right where the rib cages meet, an invisible burden, one I believe I can perceive from this distance. When he still lived here in London, hardly a week would pass without us taking a walk either through the park or along the river. We sometimes got into a debate, usually concerning an obscure literary question, arguments that, perhaps like all arguments, concealed deeper disagreements. I would sometimes, to my regret, for the gesture has always displeased me, tap my forefinger on his chest and let my palm rest there for a fleeting moment, as though to keep whatever it was that I believed I had placed there stable. And I would once again take note of the distinct pattern of his ribs, the strange way his bones protruded, as if in constant expectation of an attack. He does not know that I'm still here. He thinks I have left, rushed off to the dinner engagement I told him I was already late for. I'm not sure why I lied. "Who are you eating with?" he asked. "No one you know," I replied. He looked at me then, as if we had already parted ways and the present was the past, I standing at the shore and he on board the ship sailing into the future. That burden in the chest, I can see, has rolled his shoulders back a little, causing his hips to fall forward so as to compensate and stop him falling at the slightest push, face first. And yet, he does look, from this distance, like a man possessed by action, moving forward, determined to enter his life. These past years since 2011, since the Libyan Revolution and all that followed it, the countless failures and missed opportunities, the kidnappings and assassinations, the civil war, entire neighborhoods flattened, the rule of militias changed Hossam. Evidence of this was in his posture, but also in his features, the soft tremble in the hands, perceptible each time he brought a cigarette to his mouth, the doubt around the eyes, the cautious climate in them, a face like a landscape liable to bad weather. Soon after the start of the revolution, he returned home, and perhaps naturally, a distance opened between us. On the rare occasions he visited London, we were easy in one another's company, but less full-hearted somehow. I'm sure he too noticed the shift. Sometimes he stayed with me, sleeping on the sofa in my studio flat, sharing the same room where we could speak in the dark till one of us fell asleep. Most of the time, though, he got a room at a small hotel in Paddington. We would meet there in the neighborhood arranged around the train station, which fills the surrounding streets with a transitory air, made us both feel like visitors and accentuated the sense that our friendship had become a replica of what it had once been when he lived here and we shared the city the way honest laborers share tools. But now, when he spoke, he often looked away, giving the impression that he was thinking aloud or involved in a conversation with himself. And when I was telling him a story, I would notice myself leaning forward slightly and catch an almost querulous tone in my voice, as though I were trying to convince him of an unlikely proposition. No one is more capable of falsities, nor as requiring of them, than those who wish never to part ways.
Thank you so much. My goodness. Listening to you read that and thinking too of the sort of ambulatory background of the book,
yeah,
and how important, therefore, rhythm is to it.
Yeah.
And thinking of what you just said about the clues that you found in those first ideas for the book, there's so many clues in that first chapter for us. We realise it's going to be about places that are transitory and also places where people try to put down roots.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we could just talk a little bit about first the nature of this friendship before we talk about the other person in this triangle of friends. An interesting thing to note is that Khaled, a narrator, first encounters Hossam not in person.
No, on the page.
In a totally different way.
Yeah, he first hears a story. Hossam is a writer. And he hears a story written by Hossam, read on the radio, on the BBC Arabic World Service, when Khaled, the narrator, is still 14, living at home with his family. And they listen to the story together. And it's a very peculiar story. It's a story about a man who is eaten by his cat. And the cat comes all the way, eats the man up, and comes all the way to the head, and the man says, no, and the cat leaves. So it's obviously a political allegory, very similar to those short stories that were written at the time. I remember as a kid myself, you know, that were trying to say something about the politics without being accused of saying something about the politics. But this story infects Khaled. It infects his imagination. He was already a big reader by then, but this story really gets to him. And then later happens to become friends, you know, 10 years later happens to become friends with the author.
By which time, of course, so much has changed.
Yes, a lot has
changed. He's now a young man.
Yeah.
He has come to London. He's come to Scotland, in fact.
Yeah.
First, he goes to be a student in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
He comes to London and thereby, suddenly, in an unplanned and traumatic way, becomes
embroiled and all that. Yeah.
An embroiled person, a suspect.
Yeah.
Somebody who has to live almost underground.
Yeah.
And there's somebody who almost has no identity, has to de-person.
That's right. Yeah. There's so Khaled, 4 years after this, he has this incredible stroke of luck where he wins a scholarship to University of Edinburgh to study literature there. These were government-sponsored scholarships. And so he goes to one of these, and there he befriends the third friend in the triangle, Mustafa, who's also a student of literature. There was a joke back then that these government scholarships contained two kinds of people, readers and writers, right? People, in other words, who went to study, who were really genuinely interested in studying, the readers, and people who went to write reports about everybody else, right? But the happy majority went to do neither of those things. You know, most people went to these scholarships to have fun, to spend a couple of years abroad, not interested in reading or writing. And my two friends, Mustafa and Khalid, are readers. And they go to London because in April 1984, is a very, and some of you might remember this, but there was a very important event. A demonstration takes place in front of the then Libyan embassy on St. James's Square. Demonstrators, Libyan students, flock to London from all around the British Isles to demonstrate the attack on their colleagues back home, students that had been arrested, rounded up, tortured, a couple of them were killed. And so the students abroad think, well, we owe it to them to go and demonstrate. And because they're worried about their identities, they all wear masks and balaclavas and so on. And from the first floor window of the embassy, embassy staff fire on the demonstration. This is not me making this up. This is a real event. They shoot 11 demonstrators, Libyan demonstrators, and they kill WPC Yvonne Fletcher, a young policewoman working that day. And that event, you know, really stunned me. You know, I was much younger, my protagonist. I was 13 when it happened, 5 years younger than Khalid. But Khalid and Mustafa were 18. They go to this demonstration. They're wounded. Their whole life changes. They can't go back to Edinburgh because they're worried about being spotted by the writers. And they can't go back home because for the same reason. And so they remain in London, and really all of their expectations of what life would be like, all of their plans are upended. And they're really having to improvise like a lot of exiles and immigrants have to do. You have to sort of translate yourself into the place, and you have to translate the place back, you know, to yourself, and not only language but mannerisms, and to learn how to live away from the people that are closest to you. And they become, the three friends become their co-conspirators, as it were. They sort of, they improvise a life together and against one another. It depends at certain moments.
That was Hisham Mattar speaking at the Bibliotopia Festival at the Fondation Jan Michalski in Montrichet, Switzerland. And that's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Bill McKibben, Hisham Mattar, and the Fondation Jan Michalski.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardee.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.